Most of the news about the coronavirus lately has been bleak. Cases and hospitalizations have been surging. Utah's numbers have been in the spike phase for weeks now. The only really good news has come about vaccines. Two drug makers, Pfizer and Moderna, have recently released early analyses for their vaccines, and right now they show few side effects and effectiveness rates in the mid-90%. Now, it's unclear when most Americans will have access to the vaccines and how they're going to be mass-produced, but we'll take good news when we can get it. Of course, along with the news has come the usual stories of those skeptical about vaccination. This is actually a very old story for a very, very old procedure. The historian Nadja Durbach told us recently about the history of vaccinations. She says for hundreds of years in places like China and India, people tried some version of immunization or inoculation. For a long time, it was called variolation. It was this practice of cutting a person's skin and giving them a tiny dose of a disease like smallpox. Now, a person would usually get sick, but since it was a small dose, it wasn't fatal, and it left the person with immunity, even though back in those days, no one really understood what immunity was exactly. Durbach says the story really takes off in the 18th century with a country doctor named Edward Jenner. Jenner was doing these inoculations, these variolations with his own patients, but then he started to notice something.
He's living in Gloucestershire, and it's important that this is a dairy region. There's cattle, there's cows. And so what he begins to observe is that the dairy maids who work with the cows, who milk the cows, have very clear complexions. Smallpox leaves a lot of pitting and scarring. So if you have a clear complexion at this time, it's because you haven't got the disease. He also notices that there are stories circulating around. And these stories are that the dairy maids get an animal disease. And that animal disease is cowpox. They get that from the udders of the cows. And once they have cowpox, it turns out that they don't acquire smallpox. And what he notices is that when he tries to inoculate the dairy maids, that it doesn't take. Their bodies don't respond the same way. And he starts to see some correlation then between cowpox and smallpox. And he begins to theorize that having been exposed to cowpox also wards off smallpox. So once he's begun to see this correlation, he decides to take the next step. And the next step is an experiment. He decides what he's going to do is artificially give someone cowpox and then try and put smallpox in them and see what happens. So he takes a child as an experimental body and he takes the pussy matter out of a cowpox pustule on the hand of a dairy maid and he puts it into the body of the child. And sure enough, the child contracts a very light case of cowpox. Then he says, well, let's test whether the cowpox has an immunity to smallpox. So then he goes and he takes some smallpox matter and he does the same thing, inoculates the child with smallpox to see what happens. And again, it doesn't take. And so he begins to theorize then that there is an immunity created by the cowpox that makes the body resistant to the smallpox. So the next stage of his experiment is once he has established that immunity, he decides to figure out whether that immunity can be transferred from one person to another. So he takes the cowpox out of the child that he's artificially inoculated and he puts it in the body of another child. And sure enough, the same thing happens. So what he's proved then is that cowpox prevents smallpox, but also that cowpox can be transmitted from one human to another human to another human without losing its potency, which means you don't need to keep going back to the cow or the cowpox. You can really essentially incubate what he calls a vaccine. And this comes from the Latin word vacca for cow. You can incubate that vaccine inside the human body. And he writes this up as a report, and vaccination is born.
It seems incredibly reckless, maybe irresponsible, for him to experiment on a child. That seems kind of crazy.
We absolutely have to identify this as a questionable practice. He was certainly not the first to take advantage of people who are perhaps helpless in society. And I would say that one of the main reasons that people resisted vaccination, even long after Jenner had shown it to work, was they felt that their children were just being used in a grand experiment. We should really note that Jenner is doing something reckless.
What was the reaction to it? Because I guess on one hand, people are relieved by the idea, but horrified that they're taking something from a cow and using it for a human.
So I'd say the reaction is twofold. The medical community is really interested in this, but of course we have a public reaction as well. And lots of people are nervous about this. They don't like the idea of having bits of a cow put inside their own body or their children's bodies. This was such a new technology, and there was so much fear about what it might mean to put a foreign thing in your body that came from an animal.
Let's say it's 2021. Scientists have already developed and marketed a vaccine for COVID-19. Now they face a new problem, convincing people to actually get vaccinated with it. A Gallup poll last month.
What does the story of Edward Jenner and this discovery and his behavior and the reaction to it, what does that tell us about how people are reacting today?
Well, I think today there is a distrust of science, and I think there is a distrust of the new. And so coronavirus is a novel virus. It's called that because it's new. And we are concerned about it, how it behaves in the body, how we treat it, how we prevent it. And I think the same was true for the original vaccination. It was new and it was scary. And I think there was a distrust of science that couldn't necessarily be explained to them. So I think there's a lot of parallels. And I think we are uncomfortable with new things and uncomfortable with things that are not tried and tested. When we have the opportunity to have the coronavirus vaccine, it will not have been tested over the long term. We will be all participating in an experiment to see, well, how long does the immunity last? What kinds of side effects do we have? And that is something that will take time to play out. And so I think people were really nervous initially about new technologies. And I don't think that that's something we should attack them for. I think there are good reasons to be nervous about new things.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the history of vaccines and the history of people resisting them, because the two go hand in hand. Nadja Durbach is with us. She's a professor of history at the University of Utah. She's written about the anti-vaccination movement. She has a book called Bodily Matters. And she told us that even though some version of variolation or inoculation had been tried for hundreds of years, no one really knew why it worked, just that it did.
There were all sorts of theories of, and they had the word immunity, but they did not have a theory of the immune system until the 1890s. So they didn't understand the immune system. And this is long before germ theory. So germ theory is the idea that many diseases are caused by living organisms and that those living organisms are specific to a particular disease. So if if the organism enters your body, you're going to get a specific disease. The theory up until that point is much more complicated. It has to do with your constitutional makeup. I mean, like the kind of way in which your body works. Earlier, it had to do with the humors in your body. But really, it's about the way your body and the environment interact. And there's theories of bad smells causing disease. There's certainly an idea of contagion, that some things can be passed from person to person, but the mechanism for that is very poorly understood at this time. So when Jenner comes up with vaccination, he's not really able to say why it works, because there isn't an understanding of disease organisms and there isn't an understanding of the immune system. And so we're really working in a world in which people are using a lot of metaphors to explain how inoculation or vaccination works. My favorite one is this rabbit metaphor, this idea that when you inoculate or you vaccinate, the disease that's entering your body eats all the nutrients in your body like a rabbit would eat up all the grasses in an area. And so when the new disease enters, there's nothing left for it to eat. And so it dies. So there is this kind of sense that something living is entering your body and depleting it of the resources so that another living thing can't live off those resources. But they're not really, that's a metaphor rather than a kind of understanding of disease as a living organism in and of itself.
In your book, you write this, you write that the vaccination debate, and you write about the debate going on in England during the Victorian era. You say that it was an important place in which, and this is how you put it, the social implications of germ theory were being worked out. What do you mean there?
Well, what germ theory really does is it really focuses on the idea that some people are contagious. So in the idea that disease is sort of everywhere, you can smell it, you can walk by it, the focus of that is really dirty environments, so that some places are dirty and they breed disease. But germ theory, because it's so focused on these living organisms and people passing it from one person to another, the focus really starts to shift. The environmental stuff doesn't go away, but there is this sense that some people are more contagious than others. Some people will spread it from place to place. So there starts to be a lot of scapegoating. People start to be identified as disease carriers. We have the famous case of Typhoid Mary in the United States. Immigrants start to be targeted, poor people. And so there start to be this idea that people are harboring these dangerous microbes or bacteria, rather than the sense that it's in the environment and so we're all equally vulnerable.
So the anti-vaxxers of the past, you mention how they kept returning to this idea of rights and of citizenship. Let me ask you about the rights part. They talked about civil liberties, the sanctity of the home. So I guess working class people are talking about they want to keep control of their own bodies and the bodies of their children. Is that what that means?
Yes. So because Jenner's theory turns out in practice to be really effective, the British government mandates in 1853 that every child born in the nation gets a smallpox vaccination before they're 3 months old.
It was compulsory.
So it's compulsory. It applies theoretically at least to every single person. And really, this is the first time that the government has mandated something that actually affects and takes place inside people's bodies. So there were lots of public health campaigns, but they had to do with cleaning up the environment. They didn't impinge so much on people's bodies, and they didn't impinge really on the rights of parents. So what the compulsory vaccination law does is it interferes with the rights of parents to make their own decisions about their babies' bodies. And so many people are furious about this. And this comes, I think, in two forms. One, there's a kind of widespread resistance. We see this amongst working class people as well as middle class people against this idea that the government should have the right to tell you, A, how to parent, or B, what to do to your body or your child's body was really anathema to many, many people who thought that this interfered with their personal rights, with their rights of citizenship. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that this was understood to be class legislation. It was mandatory for everyone, but there were very easy ways of getting out of it if you had the money and the connections. There was actually no definition of what vaccination was. So if you went into your doctor and you could pay to see a doctor, this was all fee for service, and you said, you know, could you please vaccinate my child? The doctor could technically take the statue of a cow and wave it in front of your kid and say, I have vaccinated you. Or they could vaccinate your child, you know, on their toe in one teeny little spot. And that would be considered a vaccination, and they would fill out the paperwork for you. If you were working class, and this is, you know, the large majority of the population, and really by working class, what I mean by this is kind of regular, ordinary people, the kind of people we would today in the United States call hardworking middle class people. In the 19th century, these are working class people, so everyday people. They didn't have the money to pay for this, and so they had to go to a public vaccinator, someone who was a state vaccinator, who would do it for free. And that person would not wave the statue of a cow in front of you, and they would not do a little tiny mark on your child's toe. They would make usually 5 incisions on the baby's arm to be very thorough. And so you'd have really big sort of gaping wounds on the arm. And so this meant then that the way vaccination was performed on working class people was obviously much more risky than the vaccinations that were being performed on middle class people. And everybody knew this. So there's a sense of kind of a general sense of personal rights and individual liberties, but there's also this grievance from the working class that the process is actually really unequal.
This was also interesting. You mentioned how in England that the anti-vaccinators would talk about themselves as worthy citizens. And that both sides of the anti-vaccination movement, you said, used this language of citizenship. How did that work?
Well, yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, is that on the one hand, mandatory vaccination is configured as an act of citizenship, right? That if we all participate in this, we will drive out this disease from our community and from the nation. We're not yet at the concept of herd immunity, again, because we don't have an understanding of the immune system. There isn't an understanding of herd immunity, but it's a similar idea that if we all participate, then it is good citizenship to do so. But on the other hand, we have anti-vaccinators saying it's really impinging on their rights as citizens, that the right of the citizen is the right of self-determination to decide what he or she, what actions he or she are good for the self and good for the family, and that the government really doesn't have a right then to tell people what to do. And it doesn't have a right in particular to treat working class people as if they are second class citizens. Because one of the things that happened is that if you didn't vaccinate your child, you would be fined an exorbitant amount of money. And if you couldn't pay that fine, someone would show up at your house and seize all your goods and have a public auction to raise the funds to pay your fine. And if that still didn't incentivize you to vaccinate your child, you'd be fined again. And if you couldn't pay that fine, you'd be thrown in jail. But the people being thrown in jail, the people having their goods seized, were all working class people. No one is going to knock on the door of a middle class person and say, you haven't vaccinated your child, I'm going to throw you in jail. So except for the middle class people who were kind of leaders of this movement, who were very outspoken and who actually willingly went to jail as martyrs for the cause, we're not seeing a lot of middle class people being prosecuted. But again, there's this sense that working class people are diseased. They're the ones responsible. They're living in these dirty neighborhoods. Let's sort of crack down on this population. It's really being experienced. Vaccination is being experienced really unequally. So we have kind of multiple discourses of citizenship at the time.
Nadja Durbach, she's a professor of history at the University of Utah. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
When you support the news that you trust on KUER, you can easily manage your financial contribution with MyKUER. It's our online portal where you can provide your contact information, change the amount of your donation, or update your billing information, like when your credit card expires or maybe you've switched financial institutions. You can sign up for an online donor profile at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. With the good news this week that a COVID-19 vaccine is well underway, we're talking about the history of vaccines and the history of people resisting them, because the two go hand in hand. Nadja Durbach is with us. She's a professor of history at the University of Utah. She explores the subject in a book called Bodily Matters. So let's talk about the resistance to vaccinations today, because there's obviously this argument that, look, we've turned a corner, that this is a different time. We're not doing forced or compulsory procedures. We're using rigorous scientific methods. We know how to sterilize needles and knives. We understand, you know, the basic physiological systems and how they work. So how do you explain what is different about this current sense of resistance? Are there any connections here?
Yeah, well, I actually think we should go back to the early 1990s. I think there's actually a trajectory of anti-vaccination resistance. And in the early 1990s, there was the kind of birth of the organic food movement. And there was also a kind of return to the idea of naturopathy. And many, particularly sort of upper middle class parents, were kind of trying to do childbirth and also child rearing in this sort of more natural way. And so many of them turned against vaccination as a kind of unnatural act. And so initially, we start to see resistance amongst a fairly elite group of parents who are trying to kind of make the bodies of their children pure, only feed them organic homemade foods. And anti-vaccination was part of this. But this is a fairly small group of people, as you can imagine. But it's kind of in this climate that a man called Andrew Wakefield produces a so-called scientific report about the connection between the MMR vaccine, so the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, and autism. There's a kind of epidemic of autism diagnoses in the mid-1990s. Now, that may not be because there's a rise in autism. Obviously, that might just be more people are coming to understand that as a syndrome and are beginning to diagnose children with that. But Wakefield contends that autism is caused by the MMR vaccine. And he publishes a very influential paper that has since been retracted and withdrawn. And he has actually had his medical license revoked because it's fraudulent science. He has doctored the data. There may be a correlation, but there's no causal effect. And what I mean by that, because I think this can be confusing for people, is it may be that the symptoms of autism begin to appear around the same time that your child would be having their numbers of vaccinations that they have when they're toddlers. And so there might be a correlation, but that doesn't mean one causes the other. So this hits the media, though. It's widespread in the late 1990s. And even though it's denounced, retracted, and he's sort of discredited, it does create this anxiety about vaccination in the late 1990s. And then, of course, what happens is the internet.
Right.
And I honestly think the internet is the most important piece of the puzzle. And what the internet does is it provides a place for people to post information to share with each other that has not been vetted by any type of authority. And so people can post information, but there's no way to know whether that information has any basis in truth, fact. It's not being what we would call peer-reviewed, so it not being seen by experts. The methods of acquiring that knowledge have not been examined in detail. And I think this is critical. The algorithms used by many of these new kind of internet sites, let's say like YouTube, the algorithm they use is that when you're interested in something, So say you click on a video about anti-vaccinationism, the next thing it wants to show you, what it offers you, is something similar rather than something different. So what that means is the next five videos that pop up are also anti-vaccination videos. And you go down and down the rabbit hole, only ever being fed material on anti-vaccinationism. It never pops up with something that's like, this is what the CDC has to say. And so we get confirmation bias, people having an idea, they pursue that idea on the internet, and they only find more things that kind of corroborate their worldview. And that creates a climate for misinformation to spread really easily. And as we know, the internet has radicalized people around a whole range of different issues. And so I think what's happened for many people who now consider themselves anti-vaccinationists is they've been drawn into these ideas, maybe by a friend, a relative, and then they go down the internet rabbit hole, but they never are reading anything or being shown anything that allows them to understand the other point of view. So I think there's been this kind of trajectory that has really culminated in the way in which people consume only the information they're looking for on the internet.
We were talking earlier about, and you've written about this idea of trust. There used to be, when Edward Jenner was performing these procedures, there was just a kind of, I don't know if it's blind, but a kind of blind faith or trust that it in fact did work. And it seems like we're at a point in our history now as a country where there's this significant segment of the population that doesn't have a lot of social trust. And I'm wondering, that must be having an effect on the way this vaccination effort for COVID will play out, do you think?
Yeah, I think there's actually some really interesting parallels between the 19th century and today. And in the 19th century, one of the phenomenons that we see, and the reason I think why vaccination is made compulsory, is because doctors who had just been kind of regular community members in the 18th century, really in the 19th century start to professionalize, and they start to seek a kind of like monopoly over medical knowledge. They try to kind of squeeze a range of practitioners out of the practice, squeeze out the midwives, squeeze out the tax collectors from doing vaccinations and inoculations. They really want to control it. So we begin to see a kind of powerful medical lobby emerging. They really want to control who gets to practice medicine. And, you know, that has had really good outcomes, obviously, right? Yeah. We know that when we go see a doctor, we're actually seeing someone who's being trained in medicine. So that's a good thing. But I think in the 19th century, many people distrusted that. They wanted to see whatever kind of practitioner they wanted to see. They didn't want to be told who they could and couldn't see. And they began to see a kind of coalition between the government and science. And many people reacted really poorly against that. They saw this just as a kind of power grab and, again, an ability to control their bodies. And I think we're seeing that again today, this kind of widespread distrust in government. Like, what are the ulterior motives here? And kind of widespread distrust of science as well, the sense that maybe scientists are not doing this for the good of the nation, right? Maybe that they are investors in pharmaceutical companies, so they're promoting their own products. So I think that we're beginning to see a kind of reemergence of something that's fairly old, this distrust in government, this distrust in science, and this distrust of the relationship between the two. Is the government going to decide which vaccine is more effective? Is the government going to tell me which vaccine I can have? Is the government going to force me to vaccinate myself or my child? So I think that kind of distrust is really alive and well today, but actually dates back to the 1850s.
We were talking about this idea of the time when immunizations were compulsory and the resistance that you had from people and not practiced, as you said, in the same kinds of ways. If you were upper middle class or if you were in the upper classes, you didn't get the same kind of expectations for these vaccinations. Is there a parallel that you're seeing between that time and today when you hear people who resist these mask mandates? I mean, is there a connection? People are saying, I'm not going to wear a mask because it infringes on my personal liberties. Is there a connection in that in any way?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the kind of like old liberal position that the government shouldn't interfere with my body in any way is really what we're seeing playing out with the mask mandates. And I actually, even though I think wearing a mask is a good thing and I wish everyone would wear a mask, I think sometimes enforcing people to do things actually creates a backlash effect against them because they're quite concerned then about their civil liberties. And that's why what I think governments learned from the anti-vaccination movement is that education works better than compulsion, and that you need to provide people with the best understanding and then educate them to participate in the public health activity. But the mandating of something often just triggers a knee-jerk response that this is interfering with my personal rights.
Final question. What do you, when you look at the history that you know of how people have resisted and reacted to immunizations and vaccinations, can you take any lessons for what to expect for the vaccination that should be coming for COVID?
I think there's two important lessons. So the first is that it's important not to ignore or marginalize the anti-vaccination movement. I think it's quite easy, especially for people in public health professions, to have a kind of knee-jerk response and say these people are ignorant or they're troublemakers, and to dismiss them. And I think instead it would be wise to listen to what they are concerned about and then try to kind of alleviate those fears. The second important thing that I think needs to happen is a kind of educating the public around the concept of risk and how you make a decision. You know, I think that people in the 19th century were exposed to epidemic disease all the time. And so they were making these choices in an environment where they understood the risks. So if you were choosing not to vaccinate your child, you did understand the risk of that they could contract smallpox. I think today we've really lost perspective on what is risky and what is not. And I think the best example of this is that, you know, the leading cause of death for children under the age of five, and this was true through the 1990s, it may have changed today, but is traffic accidents, car accidents, something to do with a car. And yet we put our children in car seats and we drive them around town multiple times in the day. We don't clock that as risky behavior. But the people who say, well, I definitely don't want to vaccinate my child because that's too risky, they don't understand that the risk is really, really low, that there are children and adults who have adverse reactions to vaccinations, but the number of cases is incredibly low. And so if we were able to actually show people, I think, what risk looks like. So what does putting your child in a car seat and going out into traffic look like as a risk? You know, one in 15 times someone will be, you know, injured. We can represent that to people visually versus one in, let's say, 100,000. And I'm just making up these statistics. But I think if public health officials could show people what risk looked like, I think they would be able to convince people that vaccination is an incredibly effective technology. It's extremely low risk. We have now hundreds of years of data and practices to rely on, and that other behaviors that people engage in are much more risky. And so I think this is a kind of task ahead of our public health officials, is to help people make good decisions about vaccination by helping them to really understand risk and how to calculate risk and what risk looks like.
Nadja Durbach, thank you very much for the time.
It is my pleasure, Doug.
Nadja Durbach, she's a professor of history at the University of Utah. Her book is Bodily Matters, the Anti-Vaccination Movement in England from 1853 through 1907. So if you think the history of immunization is interesting, hang on, because the actual biology of all of this is pretty amazing. After a break, we'll talk about just how vaccines work. You're listening to Radio West.
KUER connects you to your community and brings you the facts about what's happening across our state. As part of our service-driven mission, we value your input. What issues should our reporters be covering where you live? Whose stories should we be telling? Do you have a question about a program or a story you heard on the station? By answering a few short questions, you can help us improve our statewide service. Consider leaving your feedback at KUER.org/feedback.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Okay, so now we know how people discovered vaccines, but just how do our bodies know what to do with them? That is, how do vaccines actually work? Dr. Josepha Steinauer is an associate professor of biology at Yeshiva University, and she wants to be clear. Humans didn't invent vaccines. Our bodies did. The discovery of vaccines was an important step forward, of course, in medical technology, but she says our bodies have known what to do with them for a very, very long time.
Viral diseases have been a part of human civilization basically as long as civilization has existed. There are, you know, some reports, even from ancient times, of viral diseases, maybe something like smallpox or measles. For example, there are reports of a plague in Athens around 430 BCE. There's evidence of pockmarks on the faces of Egyptian mummies from ancient Egyptian civilization. So viruses and other diseases have been just a part of life since life began. And actually, there are viruses that infect every single type of cell on Earth, most probably. So our bodies have evolved this really spectacular way of fighting infections, fighting disease. And that's what vaccines take advantage of. So yeah. Our bodies, when they encounter a disease, they mount an immune response and they fight away the infection, if we're lucky. And then our bodies have the capacity to remember that pathogen, that infectious agent, that disease, so that if we ever encounter it again, our body can fight it off even more effectively and more quickly than the first time. That concept or process is known as immunity. And vaccines take advantage of our body's natural ability to fight an infection and remember the infection and make us immune.
Before we get to the a little bit more on the way this works, the biology of it, tell us what you know about who may have been the first to figure this out, if we do know, how to, you know, take advantage of this really cool biological feature in our bodies. Do we know?
So again, the written records are spotty, but yeah. As far as the historical record shows, the Chinese were the first to realize. Well, no, that's not true. I want to backtrack a little bit. So already in ancient Greece, it was noted that individuals who had recovered from a disease could tend to the sick without getting reinfected. So the concept of immunity was known, you know, even since the ancient times. But the Chinese were the first to manufacture a process to develop immunity or to like artificially induce immunity.
And has it always been, or has it often been in the sort of history of all of this, this trade-off that you explained between safety and efficacy? Has there always been something controversial as far as you can tell about it?
I don't know if I would characterize it as a trade-off between safety and efficacy, but just that safety is always a concern.
Right.
So, I mean, when the Chinese were doing it, they were exposing uninfected individuals to a small amount of deadly smallpox virus. So yeah, safety has always been an issue. And when the Chinese were doing it and when it traveled to Turkey and then eventually to Europe, I mean, and eventually to the colonies as well, there were always people who died of it, even though it was, you know, supposed to be protective. So it was never 100% safe.
Yeah. Say a little bit more, if you would, about the biological mechanism that creates immunity. I suppose we have to begin with how the body fights an intruder, you know, a virus or a bacteria. How does that work?
Yeah, so when your body makes immune cells, so there are blood cells, there are white blood cells and lymphoid cells, lymphocytes, mm-hmm. that help fight infections. And these cells actually train to recognize your own cells so that you don't attack and kill your own cells. When you do, by accident, kill your own cells, that causes autoimmune disease. Most people, their cells are pretty good at recognizing their own cells. When a foreign body invades, then the cells recognize that invader because it has a different shape on its surface or different marks on its surface from your own cells, and the body tries to attack it.
So the body, the white cells, they remember – this is so fascinating to me. They remember the shape of the intruder. This is what the memory cells idea is about.
Right, right. Okay, so the lymph cells, the T and B lymphocytes, they are very special cells because they can make a cell surface protein. I'm trying to think of another word. It's like – it's called a receptor. They have these proteins on their surfaces.
Thanks for trying to make this understandable for the lay people like me. I really appreciate it.
No, stop me if I'm, you know.
No, you're great. Yes.
So all cells have proteins on their surfaces. All proteins have these little molecules on their cell surfaces. But T and B lymphocytes have special proteins on their cell surfaces that can recognize foreign agents. So your body has all these T and B cells in it, and they're constantly making new protein receptors on their cell surface that could recognize a potential foreign invader. When you actually encounter a potential foreign invader or a real foreign invader, the T or B cell, the lymphocyte that has a receptor on its cell surface that matches the shape of the proteins on the surface of the invader, they get activated. So it's almost like your body's doing this empirical process where it's making all these T and B cells that like have all these different shapes of proteins on their cell surface. But when the protein on their cell surface happens to match the shape of an invader, they get activated. And so they get activated to fight off this invader initially, but they can also, some of them can be activated to become memory cells. And then those memory cells can last years or decades or even a lifetime, so that they're still carrying that unique protein on their cell surface that can recognize that specific invader, so that if you ever encounter that invader again, they're on it.
Wow. So the memory cells remember what the foreign agent, the virus or whatever, what it was shaped like, what it looked like. But does it also – it also remembers how it fought it. Like this is what
That's
we
true.
Did to kill this thing. Wow.
Right. That's true. That's absolutely true. Yeah.
That's
so
kind
that
of amazing.
It's amazing. And so they can not only remember that guy and say, hey, that guy's bad news, we got to get rid of him, but they can say, we can get rid of him faster and more effectively this time because we know what worked the last time.
So you mentioned that sometimes they last decades, even a lifetime. But I wonder, can the body at times forget the intruder, forget how it fought the intruder? Does that happen sometimes?
That definitely happens, yeah. And that's why you need boosters for some of your vaccines. So I think tetanus, you need a booster every 10 years, right? So to remind your body.
What about COVID? I mean, I know it's early days. Do we have a sense of whether the same process is happening? And as far as you can say, what do you understand about the way this process is playing out, what they're figuring out about memory cells? And is it typical? Is it different? Do we even know at this point?
As far as I understand, I don't think we know that much at this point. I think we're still learning a lot about this disease, but we know that it induces an antibody response. So antibodies are those cell surface proteins that I was talking about on B cells. Those are the proteins that recognize the invader. So the fact that COVID, the coronavirus, the novel coronavirus, makes an antibody response means that you have B cells getting activated that match it, that recognize it, and fighting it off. So presumably some of those B cells would remember, be converted into memory cells and hold that memory. How long does it hold that memory? That we don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the problem is that also some viruses are very sneaky and they can change the shapes of their surface molecules. So even though you have some memory cells that remember the first guy that invaded you, now the guy takes on a slightly different shape or a slightly different appearance, and the original memory cells don't recognize him.
That's why I need a flu vaccine every year, right? Because
yes.
It keeps shifting. It's so smart.
Exactly. I wouldn't call it smart, but it's sneaky.
No, right. Yeah. Sorry. It seems clever, but it doesn't work that way. So your focus is you know, biology, not history. I know that. But I did want to ask about what got you interested in vaccines and maybe the history part, because you say it started when some of your students, and I guess these were non-science students, they asked you to put together this lecture on vaccines.
Yeah. I mean, immunology is not, I have to be honest with you, immunology is not my field of research. So I was asked to teach a science course for non-scientists at my university, Yeshiva University, and I jumped in with zeal because I think it's important for everybody to learn a little bit of science. And initially, I had focused my lectures on molecular genetics, which is my field of research. But the students in the course the first year asked me if I could do a lecture on vaccines. So I started, you know, reading a little bit and researching, and I just stumbled into the history of vaccines, which I found so fascinating. And I felt like it was perfectly appropriate for non-science students because I didn't want to burden them with all of the molecular details that we know about immunology and virology. I mean, there's so much, and it's amazing how much we know. I mean, it's really, you know, biomedical science and research right now is spectacular. But for these early students, I wanted them to really get the take-home message that, as you said, vaccines are not some like crazy space-age technology. Humans have been trying to vaccinate themselves, protect themselves against disease since, you know, ancient history, and we're really just taking advantage of the body's natural ability to fight off an infection. So that's kind of the perspective that I took when I taught the class, that I wanted the students to appreciate how amazing biology is and not get so focused on, you know, ideas of technology.
One of the things you've said is that there's always been this resistance to vaccines. And I'm wondering, what did looking at the history tell you about that and about the maybe giving some perspective on the moment we're in, you know, this urgent search for the right vaccine to deal with the coronavirus, but also this kind of suspicion of it and resistance and lack of social trust?
You know, I have to admit, when I started putting together this lecture, I was very biased against the anti-vax community being a scientist. But delving into the history actually made me appreciate how common it is and it was throughout history for people to resist vaccination. And for so many different reasons, it's not monolithic, the opposition to vaccination. There's a lot. It's a really interesting history, and it actually led to some good things, like opposition to vaccination in the early 20th century in the United States led to the first food and drug regulation at the federal level. So, you know, I think it's understandable. As we said, there's always risk involved. So the very first forms of inoculation involved exposing people to very deadly smallpox virus, and it definitely led to death in some cases. So that, you know, those risks have always been there. Even later, once safer vaccines were developed, those vaccines often carried other types of infectious agents. Often they were contaminated with bacteria. There was a big tetanus outbreak in the early 20th century in, I think, around Philadelphia due to a vaccine. So, you know, there's always risks associated with vaccination, and those risks can sometimes be very overt, like the vaccine can harm you or it can be carrying, you know, it can be contaminated with something that can harm you. But sometimes the risks can be as simple as the inoculation didn't work as well as you thought it did. So you think you're immune, but you're actually not. Or as we mentioned before, your immunity can fade over time. So you get a false sense of security. And I think that's one of the fears nowadays with the current coronavirus vaccines that are being developed, that if they're not as effective as we hope they will be, we might get a false sense of security.
So it seems like we're in this place where there's this, you know, part of the population that doesn't have what I've been hearing lately is described as a lot of social trust, you know, trust in social and governmental institutions. And I'm wondering how you're thinking about that and whether that could complicate the rollout of the vaccine right now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is political, but interestingly, it's not coming from one end of the political spectrum. I think it's coming from both ends. So there are people on the left who are very like focused on natural remedies and homeopathy, and those people are rejecting vaccination as being part of the medical establishment. But then you also have religious people on the right who are rejecting vaccination. So it is an anti-government or like an anti-establishment movement, I think, but I don't think it's limited to one political persuasion.
Hmm. You say you think COVID-19 has been good for vaccines. It's getting kind of a PR boost right now?
I think so. That's my hope.
Yeah.
Because, you know, vaccination rates were getting alarmingly low in the United States. We had a couple of huge measles outbreaks recently. Mm. The anti-vax movement has been gaining in popularity in recent years. So hopefully people will get to witness with COVID-19 firsthand how amazing vaccination is. In some ways, vaccination has been a victim of its own success because in the 20th century, we have been so successful at eradicating so many severe diseases that now in the 21st century, we don't have a very strong historical memory of how terrible those diseases were and how effective vaccination was. So now the threat of the more nebulous threats surrounding vaccination become more frightening and more real than the threat of those diseases, which, you know, people in our lifetimes have never seen. My hope is that seeing a pretty severe novel disease being, let's say, tamed by current vaccination efforts, my hope is that that will remind everyone of how miraculous vaccination is.
Josepha Steinauer, thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Josepha Steinauer. She's an associate professor of biology at Yeshiva University. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.